Okay, as I was saying, so we started back in November. The purpose of this particular series was modern Jewish history, laying the ground. We wanted to start from the mid-1800s and bring us up to the end of the First World War. That was going to be series one. Mirtz Hashem, next year we'll do series two, taking us from the end of World War One through, I hope, the end of World War Two. Maybe we'll even actually get through the birth of the State of Israel. We'll see how long it takes us to get there. As we work through, in the last 150, 200 years, Jewish history. So we've extended way beyond February. We're almost at the end of April. This is our 11th class in the series. It's been a wonderful journey for me, learning, preparing for this. I hope for you as well. We'll do a couple of other things in the summer months, and then again, as we normally do, as we come out of the Yom Tovim, Mirtz Hashem, next September, October, we'll begin the next part of the series, which again will be taking us from World War One, the end of World War One, or the aftermath of World War One, into the next 20, 30 year period of the earliest 20th century. Okay, what I want to do for this class is really three things as we tie up the series. Number one is zero in, focus in a little bit on some of the details of what it was like for the Jewish community. Last week we spoke about the Russian Revolution. The previous week we spoke about the Balfour Declaration. I just want to talk a little bit about what some of the experiences were like for the Jews in Russia, particularly in Vilna, which was the Jerusalem of Europe, if you will, as it was often referred to, the center of the Jewish world at the time, just to get a little inkling of the type of suffering, the decisions that needed to be made, the difficulties that they had during this time. Focus in a little bit as well on the Treaty of Versailles, which really ends the war. The war had actually ended a little bit before, but really focus in on how that particular treaty, while ending one world war, really laid the groundwork for the Second World War. It's really, historians have at this point pretty much looked at the two world wars as one long continuum. Even though there was a 20-year gap between the end of the first and the beginning of the second, the second is already coming out of the first, and much of that comes from this particular treaty. The treaty itself we could discuss at great length. We're just going to touch on it a little bit, just really as a conclusion of our series. And Mirtz Hashem, again, next series, we'll pick up a little bit the pieces of what comes from this treaty as it then takes us through the next 20 years of Jewish history. Okay, let's begin. Part 11, the lasting impact of this Great War. This Great War, of course, from 1914 to 1918, which we've mentioned was a disaster on every level, from the countries that were involved, the numerous countries that were involved, the loss of life measured in 10 million, the amount of wounded, the complete destruction of infrastructure in so many countries. So that we've touched on. Let's focus in a little bit, as I mentioned, on Vilna and some of the Jews in Russia. So on the left-hand side of your screen, the Russian war machine would enlist, this is going back, this is World War One, between 12 and 15 million soldiers. It's a tough number to wrap one's mind around. Those were the numbers of men that were forcibly, or some of them were probably actually lifelong soldiers, but enlisted into the Russian war machine, of which millions of them would never return, and even many who would return would never return whole or the same. The Jewish soldiers' estimates range somewhere between 400 and 600,000, which is a very large number of Jews, of which at least 100,000 of which will be killed, and many more, of course, maimed and wounded. There's much discussion in the history books, in the historical accounts as to the role that the Jew played in the Russian war machine. And what I mean by that is, on the German side, as we spoke about, the German and Russians are, of course, the main antagonists in this war. The Jews fought on Germany's side and were very prominent in the war. They were great in number and mostly in rank and where they served. Even though what's going to happen, as we'll see, is the stabbed in the back theory, in which the Hitler and his and many of the cronies in Germany are going to eventually blame the Jews. But the Jews fought; they were involved. in Russia, they were never given equal rights within the Russian army. They were always mistreated. They were always in the bottom of the ranks. They were not allowed to serve as official officers, but they were served in great numbers. Shortly after the breakout of the war, the Grand Duke Nicholas Nikolaevich, who was the commander-in-chief of the Russian army, evacuates all Jews from the western provinces. Now, the western provinces, of course, are on the front where they're fighting with Germany. And he just evacuated all of them. Tens of thousands, they estimate 22,000 refugees, stream into Vilna. Vilna is the center, as I mentioned before, of Jewish life. It's the center of religious life. It's a center of Jewish life in every way. It was known as the Jerusalem of Europe at the time. And 22,000 refugees come streaming in to Vilna with nothing but the clothing on their back. And it's as much as we discussed last week, you know, all the various revolutions, sometimes just to put yourself in the, you know, in a simple Jew living in Vilna, what it was like, where every shul is overrun with people living in the shul. There's food shortages throughout the entire country. There's a war going on. And now you have this responsibility of taking in all of these brethren who need places to sleep, health care, and clothing, warm clothing, coats, boots, you name it, what it was like. And it's not like, it's like, try to imagine that under normal circumstances here in a city the size of Montreal, if we had to absorb that kind of number of people. But imagine doing so in the middle of a war. Tremendous strain. Now, this is besides the fact that as trainloads of wounded soldiers would arrive in Vilna, which was this major hub, the Russians had basically put in the Jews, not in charge in a way, but they were responsible for tending to them as well. There were two major worldwide committees which were created during this time, which still exist until this day. One is the Joint Distribution Committee. The Joint Distribution Committee, which was a merger of several other American-based organizations, was originally created as an emergency relief to the Jews of Palestine in 1914. You remember we've spoken about many times over the course when we started already in 1850s, as with the first wave of Aliyah, the second wave of Aliyah, you couldn't live in the Palestine. You couldn't make a living, really, is the way that I should say. You could definitely live in the land of Palestine. You couldn't make a living there. So how did they support themselves with what was known as the Chalukah? The Jews of Europe would all funnel money to Israel, to the land of Palestine, would be divided over there, as we've discussed that on many occasions. When the war breaks out in 1914, that becomes impossible. There was no way to get money from Russia through all the lands they would have to get to the land of Israel. Russia is the largest Jewish community. 3 million Jews, we said, lived in Russia at the time of the breakout of the war. So immediately upon the beginning of the war, the Jews in Palestine are in dire straits. So the Joint Distribution Committee is originally created in the U.S. to take care of the Jews of Palestine during the war, which everybody thought was going to be relatively quick. But there was no way to support the Jews that were there. So they create this Joint Distribution Committee. As the war drags on, that organization becomes the lifeline of the Jews in Europe, because the Jews in Russia, the Jews in Germany, the Jews all over are suffering everywhere. And as we see, particularly in Russia, all the communities are destroyed. The infrastructure is destroyed. There are refugees everywhere. And this joint distribution is literally the lifeline of, as money is funneled from the U.S., Canada, to these communities to be able to support them. The leader in Vilna at the time was Reb Chaim Moisher Gradensky. Tremendous Talmud Chacham. There have been biographies written about him. I have one over here. It is a tremendous work describing this, what this Jew, this giant of a Jew, shouldered in terms of all of these refugees, all of the problems, and he was the Gadol Hador, the leader of the generation, responsible for so much. So he organized another organization called Ezra's Torah. He was the driving force behind it, which was created in the States, which was really created by the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America and Canada, which was also an amalgamation of several other Orthodox-run organizations, and they also funneled money specifically to the Orthodox communities of Europe at the time, which is an organization that still exists until today. So it's just interesting to note historically where these things began and why this was the time, and these Jewish communities could not have survived without these two organizations who funneled literally millions of dollars through the warriors to be able to keep them afloat. But as the Russian military suffers defeat after defeat at the hands of the Germans, the Jews, unfortunately, were regularly blamed. They were blamed as spies, as traitors. There are pamphlets printed up as such. The official Russian army would claim as such, which would lead to whether or not they were called fully blown pogroms. But there were, it's like hard to describe. When the armies are running wild, it's a military time. The Jewish communities were left completely unprotected. Nobody cared. And these small little shtetlach throughout White Russia were subject to just vicious attack. They were plundered one after another. I just want to read, I'm not going to read the whole thing. There was a book that was written by Rabbi Yehuda Lev Graubert. Describing, he was a rav in one of the towns in the neighboring Vilna at the time, and just to describe what it was like for the Jews at the time, he describes Yom Kippur one year. This is, I believe, 1917 or 1916. It was late afternoon, Yom Kippur afternoon. This is in the town of Stoshov, and the Jews are in shul reciting Ne'ilah at the end of Yom Kippur. This town had already been the scene of a pogrom. All of the Jewish-owned stores were being looted regularly by the soldiers that occupied the town. And suddenly, in the middle of Ne'ilah, a child runs into the shul shouting, "A Jew is hanging in the street!" The congregants dashed out and were met by the sight of a lifeless body dangling from a lamppost. And they recognized the victim as the Jew from the neighboring town, Shatzizgan. So he writes, Rav Graubert, he says, "I was the town, I was the local Rav. I'm leading Ne'ilah in my little shul, and we run out during Ne'ilah, and there's a Jew hanging from a lamppost. So I, the local Rav, ran about frantically trying to discover what's going on, what led to this. And I was met by a Gentile who informed me that a Cossack band had just murdered 10 additional Jews on the outskirts of town. That night, after Yom Kippur, a widow of one of the victims of the 10 who were murdered outside of town related to me what happened. The previous night, Erev Yom Kippur, Kol Nidre night, the house of one of the gentle farmers in the neighboring town in Shatzizgan caught fire. The next morning, the farmer's wife came to our town, to the hospital, to procure some salve for her, the burns on her hands. And while she's in our town, she met a shoemaker. And she told him, our house had a fire last night. I'm here to get the medicines that we need." The shoemaker asked her if she suspected arson, to which she replied, "No, not at all." The shoemaker countered, "Aren't there any Jews in your town? For sure one of them lit your house on fire." The woman actually did not need much convincing and began to think which Jew would have a personal grudge against her family. And then she remembered that indeed 2 weeks previously, when she had accompanied some Cossacks when they looted a Jewish store, that owner of that Jewish store, "Aha," she said, "it must be him." The shoemaker said, "Indeed, without a doubt, the storekeeper who had been looted, he was the arsonist." And they were soon standing before the army commandant, accusing the Jew of a crime neither knew nothing about. The army took no time at all to determine that he was guilty, went to shul to find him, and found him and 10 others on Yom Kippur in their shul. The Jew who they claimed had set the fire, they hung on a lamppost, and the other 10 took to the edge of town to dispose of out of sight. That was his firsthand account of what it was like being a Rav during this terrible time and the outskirts of Vilna. Rav Chaim Ozer himself, who again was the Gadol Hador, the leader of this entire community, was given a night's notice that he was on a list of political prisoners to be taken as the Russians began to be defeated and fled from the town, and he himself therefore flees and lives in exile outside of Vilna for about a year or two until he comes back in 1919. There are hundreds of thousands of Jews in from Poland and Lithuania, which had been under Russian control at the beginning of the war, who are, because of all of the war zones, are literally uprooted and just begin to wander deeper and deeper into Russia. They have nowhere to go. Each point, they're like towns and shtetl are filled, and they just keep moving east, deeper and deeper into Russia. There is no shuls, there are no communities, no mikvos, kashrus, there isn't anything for them during this particular time. And Reb Chaim Ozer himself, from his own exile, is literally working together with others, just trying to manage the situation. In Vilna itself, Vilna itself is just a story of just try for a moment to imagine surviving or living through this. In Vilna, which again was this big hub, of a very large percentage, I forget the exact numbers, they estimate 40 to 60% was Jewish in Vilna. The Germans seized control of it early in the war. Food shortage is widespread, rationing out of food, they confiscate the Germans anything of value. There are forced labors, disease, typhoid. Between 1915 and 1917, 7 of the 60,000 Jews who live in Vilna die, not from war, just from disease and starvation. 7,000 out of the 60,000 Jews. It's a very a high percentage. In 1918, the Germans eventually are defeated and retreat out of Vilna, and that creates a three-way struggle between Poland, Russia, and Lithuania, all who were licking their chops to finally be able to take over Vilna from the Germans. Vilna, just the history of the city of Vilna, which again had been a Jewish stronghold for hundreds of years, of course most famous for the Gaon of Vilna, known as the Vilna Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu of Vilna in the 1700s, late 1700s. Vilna had been the capital of Lithuania from 1300s, 1323. And then the Poles had made some deal, pact with Lithuania. The Poles took it over in the mid-1600s, in 1669. But then the Russians took it over in the beginning of the 1800s. And then the Germans took it over from the Russians. So it was the capital of Lithuania under Russian rule for 100 or so years. The Germans then conquer it in the beginning of World War I. And now that the Germans flee in 1918... everybody wants it back. The Poles want it back. Lithuania wants it back. The Russians want it back. Listen to what happens. January 1st in 1919, the Polish legionnaires come into the city and they take it. The Germans have been fleeing. Poles take it. 5 days later, the Red Army comes in and Russia takes it from the Poles. But that only lasts for 3.5 months because in April, the Poles take it back from the Russians. They celebrated by looting the Jews. The final stand that the Russians had was in a Jewish cemetery. And the Poles who defeated the Russians in the Jewish cemetery claim that that was a sign that the Jews were really on the side of the Russians. And they take out in their victory celebrations, they take it out on the Jews, looting, they desecrate the cemetery. Literally 80 Jews in a 2 or 3 day period are just literally picked off the streets and killed, dragged through the streets. Terrible accounts we have of when the Poles took it back in April. But that doesn't last very long because about a year and a few months later, in July of 1920, the Russians conquer it back from the Poles and give it to Lithuania because they had made a pact with Lithuania, and part of that pact was that Russia was going to conquer the Vilna and give it back to the Lithuanians. But that only lasted 6 weeks before the Poles reconquer it from the Lithuanians who had been given it by the Russians, and the Poles would hold on to it for the next 20 years until it's completely swallowed up by the Nazis and the famous Vilna ghetto and the deportations that followed from there. So a Jew in Vilna, literally, besides for the war, but from the start of the war, would go from German hands to Polish hands to Russian hands to Polish hands to Lithuanian hands to Polish hands within a very short period of time. It was not a safe place to be, to say the least. But just to express some of what it was like during the Jews in this time. To shift to Russia just for a moment, in 1917, which we spoke about last week after the February Revolution, so we mentioned the February Revolution brought freedom. It brought the ability to have political rights. to the Jews for the first time in Russia, which was celebrated by Jews everywhere. And in the months right after the February Revolution, dozens of Jewish political parties were formed. Many of them were secular, and the Orthodox also jumped in and set up a number of parties as well. Those Orthodox parties, there were so many of them, merged into one group known as Achdus, which of course means unity, and actually held two conferences, two political conferences for this Orthodox political party, and the leaders of the generation were present at these. Chafetz Chaim, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Chaim Ozer himself. This was a major to-do. There were 80 delegates at the first, about 200 delegates at the second, were held in June and in July, and it was a dream come true. They were still in the midst towards the end of the war in June in 1917, but after hundreds of years of oppression that the Jews had suffered from in Russia, all of a sudden the emancipation of the February Revolution, they had their own political parties, and it was going to be a time of flourishing of Jewish life in Russia. And I mention this just because it's so important historically to look back and learn from what took place. We know, as we learned last week, the February Revolution only lasted until October when the Bolsheviks come to power, overthrow the provisional government that was in, institute a program of communism, and that was the end. All of those political parties died out with the death of the February Revolution and the provisional government that was put in place. And the dreams and the hopes that rested on the Jews of the time that they were going in a certain direction were very much dashed just a short few months after that revolution. And it's just it's a fascinating historical reality to be able to scale back, because we so often find ourselves, as we go through, there'll be classes 70, 80, 100 years from now looking back at what's going on in our day and age, and to sort of see things in the historical perspective. You know, a Jew living in January 1917 in Russia would have had one reality. In March of April of that same year would have had a totally different reality after the February Revolution. And just 6 months later, in November of the same year, a third completely different reality. And that's what happened. That was the reality of what took place in Russia in 1917. And unfortunately, the last stop was communism, and we, as we discussed last week, was a terrible tragedy for the Jewish people, of which we continue to suffer from today. Let's talk a little bit about the end of the war. Again, without getting into the great history of the war, which is in itself, of course, fascinating. The war ends. The war ends in 1918, in November of 1918, but the treaty is not signed. The Treaty of Versailles is not signed until June of 1919. So it takes almost a full year, 8-9 months of negotiations until it's actually signed. The background, the Kaiser Wilhelm II was the Emperor of Germany. Remember, before the war, there were several empires, four empires, which do not make it through the war. The Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, and the Ottoman Empire all collapse as a result of this war. So there's literally an entire new world order that is ushered in through this great war, which I just have to just take a step back. If you remember how the war started with a single assassination of the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in Sarajevo, if you think about that one bullet, what came about, how the world shifted because of one bullet, it's astounding to just try to contemplate how that act set in motion this world war, which literally changed the world order. Four empires are reshaped. You know, they crumble, and what comes in their wake, World War I followed by World War II, which is followed by the birth of the modern state of Israel, which we're headed to. In any case, back to Germany for a moment. So there was an emperor of Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm II, who was also, it's of course, commander-in-chief of the German armed forces. And by November 1918, even though Germany had done very well in the beginning of the war, they ran into the Russian bear, the Russian winter, bit off more than they could chew, and too many different fronts. And eventually the U.S. enters the war in late 1917, And Germany is defeated. Many of the other of its allies had signed individual peace treaties and pacts of armistices along the way. But the final one is, of course, with Germany. During this time, and by November 1918, the Kaiser has a series of serious problems on his hands. Number one, the German Imperial Navy has a mutiny. They're finished. There's tremendous unrest at home, harsh conditions of war, there are food shortages, and there's a rising support for various extremist parties throughout Germany. And as a result of all of these things, mostly drawn by the defeat in the war, in November 9th of 1918, the Kaiser abdicates his throne and personally flees to Holland out of Germany. Power is handed to a government led by the leader of the left-wing Social Democratic Party, Friedrich Ebert, and there's a new era in Germany. But we'll see, similar to Russia, when you all of a sudden take hundreds of years of a certain type of government, a kingdom, an empire, and then it becomes democratic, it doesn't always go so smooth. The Russian Revolution lasted 7 months until the Bolsheviks came to power, and that was the end of that. And we're going to see literally, in a way, that's exactly what's going to happen in Germany, but for a little bit of a different story, which is worth focusing on for our purposes. The Treaty of Versailles is signed in June of 1919. The negotiations on this treaty were held exclusively between Britain, France, and the U.S. Germany, who is the vanquished, is not invited to contribute to the discussions at all. They are not a part of the dialogue, not a part of the negotiations, not a part of the peace treaty. Germany worked with the assumption that the treaty would reflect the 14-point plan, which is set up by President Woodrow Wilson. The 14 points, I should have given a separate slide with what those are. Those 14 points are an end of the war. It basically, not going through all of the 14, looks to create free trade, no more secret pacts. The First World War is marked by this one made a secret pact with this, and then they made a secret pact with that one, and then all of those problems. None of the secrecy, open diplomacy, open trade, a restructuring of borders, and resetting certain things. It's a wonderful document. It has absolutely nothing to do with Germany. There are no ramifications, no payments, no guilt, no blame, no limitations. It is simply the 14 points of how do we get out of this war and restructure Europe to be able to move forward in peace. That's Woodrow Wilson's 14-point plan. However, France would have none of it. France, which had suffered considerably in the war, was seriously intent on both paying back Germany for starting this war, and if you remember, they had lost the war to Germany 30 years prior, and they also wanted to make sure that Germany would never get the type of power to be able to do this again. And France pushes through a different type of treaty entirely than anything that Wilson had recommended in his 14 points. And what ends up coming out of this treaty, of which Germany again is not part of, has a certain clause known as the War Guilt Clause, in which Germany had to accept complete responsibility for the war. Now, accepting complete responsibility for a world war that took over 4 years and cost millions and millions of lives, besides for the financial damage, was quite a statement, not just to say, but then to have to act on that this was your fault. Germany was then required to give up 13% of its land, 12% of its population that lived in what was then the German Empire would be ceded to the Allies, which would take up 48% of their iron production and a large production of its coal, and severely limit its economic power. They were going to limit its soldiers to 100,000, its navy to 15,000, and as a financial compensation, the Allies demanded large amounts of what became known as the reparations, which was a massive financial burden which was going to be placed upon Germany. So that it basically took land, it took resources, it took cash, and it severely limited its army. That's what was pushed through. The idea, when it was presented to Germany, was, you can understand, immensely unpopular in Germany and was viewed as extremely harsh. Now, the new German government is faced with the revolutionary atmosphere at home, facing tremendous shortages from conditions of the war, and the German government reluctantly agreed with two exceptions. They did not accept admitting total responsibility. They came back to the Allies and said, we accept, but we won't take responsibility. And they would not accept that the former Kaiser should be put on trial for, which is one of the other things that the Allies demanded. The Allies reject the proposal and demand that they accept all terms unconditionally or face returning to war. All of the Allied warships remained in Europe ready to re-engage Germany. The German government, who actually did had meetings with their army whether or not they could withstand a second attack, and they basically, the army said, we have nothing left. So the German government has no choice, and representatives of the new parties in power signed the treaty in June of 1919, which is literally, they were viewed as traitors. The Germans were outraged by the treaty. They regarded it as what they called the Diktat, which was a dictated peace. We were not part of it. The government officials who signed were called the November criminals by the right-wing and nationalistic parties that opposed this treaty. Now, two major points that come out of it. Again, there, you could read, there's many, many works on the Treaty of Versailles and its outgrowths. So I want to just focus on two. Number one was the result from Germany. Number one, its economy is in shambles, but not just from the war, but then based on the fact that they just lost land, resources, the coal, and iron, and they had these tremendous payments that they were required to make. So literally hyperinflation, the country is in economic shambles. What we've learned historically, whenever there is this terrible economic shambles, a proud country, and Germany is nothing if not for a proud country, is going to look to place the blame on someone. It can't be that we lost a war, which again we mentioned before, there was not a single battle fought on native German land. So for the population to come to terms with a lost battle, how could we lose? We were never attacked. We didn't lose anything on it. It's not possible. There has to be something here. Someone has to be at fault. So Hitler is going to be very quick to lay the blame really on two entities at the same time. Number one, he's going to blame it on the Weimar Republic, which was that first government that was put in place, who were in, like the Russians, just a lose-lose situation, because they're the first government to take power, taking power as a result of a lost war, and were given a mess. They were given such a mess that then when the Allies, trying to be strong and strong-arm the Germans into submission, gave them such a strong treaty in the Allies' favor against Germany, the government that they had put in place was crippled by the Allies' own desire to keep them weak. But all that that did is made it ripe for a mutiny against that first government. And who's going to be the strong one to come in and do that? That's going to be the person of Hitler. Yimach Shemo v'zichro. And so when we look at it historically, the Allies, led by the French, desire to keep the Germans in their place, actually undermined the very job that they were trying to do by taking away the popularity of the government that was just put in place, because they're the ones who signed this treaty, to which Hitler and all of the extremist parties that were there, all the nationalistic parties were saying, you destroyed us, you're a traitor to our people. And that gave rise to their popularity. The second group, of course, that Hitler blames, we're all familiar with, is he blames the Jews. There has to be someone at fault. The Weimar Republic, they just took over now. But it was the Jews who stabbed the German soldiers in the back. We mentioned this this theory before, which he promulgated, that it has to be that while our loyal German soldiers were out there at war, somebody back home must have been stabbing them in the back, which caused this terrible, humiliating defeat. And so those two things are going to combine: the fall of the original democratic government, together with the blame that they shared and the blame on others, is going to eventually give rise to the tremendous popularity that the nationalistic parties harbored, which of course is going to be gathered up all into one, the Nazi party that Hitler, of course, is going to take control over. What the treaty also did, very importantly, is it creates many new countries around Germany. All of that land that they took from Germany and all of these empires that collapsed were formed into several, many new countries. These new countries are, by definition, as new, they are all weak and they are all fractured, because when the new borders were drawn, they're just drawn based on land requirements, but they didn't take into account all of the indigenous populations, which were made up of many different groups, many different religious groups, socioeconomic groups, cultural groups, that never got along. For hundreds of years, they hadn't gotten along. And now all of a sudden, they happen to be drawn around the same area, and they become one country, which continued to keep them from ever coalescing into some type of strong nation. So that, again, what the treaty tried to do is going to literally backfire, in that all of the areas around remain weak, whereas Germany, after a few years of terrible depression, economic depression, when it gets its feet back on the ground and begins to recover, the nationalistic parties are going to be strong, are going to unify a nation that's going to be stronger than all of its neighbors, which were newly founded and fractured, and are actually not going to be in a position. Poland, having just gotten its freedom from Russia after a couple of hundred years of Russian rule, are not in a position to be ready to take on the German military, which is going to need less than 20 years to establish itself as the most powerful nation in the region. And so the very thing that the treaty was trying to do, which was an overzealous treaty, ends up completely giving rise to the opposite. It creates a very powerful, angry, vengeful nation looking to restore its honor amongst the world. And when you combine that with the type of person that Hitler was, with his oratory skills and his ability to be a rabble-rouser, we end up with what we're familiar with, and doesn't need to be overstated, the terrible disaster that the Holocaust in World War II is going to create. It's of note, it's literally 20 years after Germany was subdued at the end of World War I, and with this treaty was supposed to be crushed and kept in its place. And it doesn't happen in any way, shape, or form that way. And those are some of the just the important elements that come out of this particular treaty as we conclude. So let's just take a minute of what we've done. We started in the 1850s with the Mussar movement, as the Jews in Russia and in Europe are coming out of a very difficult middle-aged period, and begin to look inward and begin to develop, which leads to there's a rebirth. We spoke about the Chovevei Tzion and the rebirth of the love and the return to Tzion, to the land of Eretz Yisrael, and the first Aliyah, which was very much kicked off by the Russian pogroms of the 1880s. But from that first Aliyah from 1880 to 1900, in which tens of thousands of Jews begin to return, begin to resettle the land, we learned about the Dreyfus Trial. Separate from this Aliyah movement back to the land, we had the Dreyfus Trial, which is going to inspire Herzl to begin political Zionism, to begin a movement after, again, we've already had 30, 40 years of Jews beginning to return. He takes the lead on the political movement, the first Zionist Congress of 1897, and then the continuing development of that particular Congress, the second wave of Aliyah from the early 1900s, 1903 to 1913, all of while that is going on, we then began the discussions of the First World War which happens while this is taking place. So what we've really addressed is two separate fronts. We spent a lot of time on development in Palestine, which we really are still now in the 1914s. It's really an undeveloped place as far as economy goes, and the Jews returning, not so many have become. We've had two waves. We focused on Europe, Russia, Germany, what's going on there between 1914 and 1918. Mirtz Hashem, when we pick up again, we're going to have to address the third front, which is North America, where Jews are beginning to flee to from various other places, and that community is developing. And that will then bring together our three major theaters, if you will, the North American Jewish world, the European Jewish world, the Palestinian Jewish world over the next 20 years from 1920 to the end of the Second World War. And then I assume those last 3 years will be a course unto itself from 1945 until 1948. We'll see how we'll divide it up, but that'll be our next journey as we go through Jewish history over the last century. So it's been really a pleasure working it through, going over this all together over the last 11, 12 sessions, a couple of months we've spent. We're going to do a couple of other various studies over the summer, and then we'll pick up again with some more Jewish history, God willing, after the Yom Tovim.